But thanks a lot, Dick. Great information, and we'll get some more for next week. KC2WGB, back to you.
Gee, I was prepared for your circuit, for your guy who asked the question about what happens when you go from liquid to solid, or liquid to gas. You sure you don't want to go to that one tonight? Because I don't have the whole answer, but I got a part of the answer on that one, John. Over to you, John. KQLIW.
KC2WGB. Okay, Dick, just let me specify what the question was, and then you can go on. All right, this young ham is trying to understand the atomic structure, and he looks at something like, say, mercury, basically a metal, but it's flexible, it's a liquid. Now you have steel. They're made of atomic structures. They're both elements. What keeps the steel rigid? Why isn't the mercury rigid? Why aren't they similar? What is the secret? So I know we discussed this before on the web, but maybe you've come up with a little better answer. So give it a try, Dick. KC2WGB, back to you.
I'm not an expert in this area, I'll warn you. And there could be some significant error on what I'm going to tell you.
Science teacher couldn't explain it to him. What do you think of that, Dick?
The science teacher couldn't explain it to him for a very good reason. The training the science teacher got didn't explain it. The science teachers I had didn't explain it. The physics courses I went to didn't explain it. And I've, in the last few years, studied it to some degree, looked at various websites, talked to various people. And some of the companies I work for, occasionally you'll run into a plastics expert, a chemistry expert, and whatever, and you ask him questions about Thompson's law and whatever, and you slowly get some hints. The thermodynamics course we study should have told us this. They don't. They favor the PV equals MRT equation, which tells you how much, doesn't tell you why, doesn't tell you how. What really is the difference between a gas, a liquid, and a solid? As I said, I've come up with a mental model that works for me. As I said, it could have some error, so I'm going to give you that caveat, but it works for me. I'm going to tell you what it is. Let me drop. First of all, you realize that almost every substance on that periodic table, depending on what temperature the substance is at, in most cases, that substance has a solid form if the temperature is low enough, a liquid form if the temperature is a little bit higher, and a gaseous form when the temperature is higher yet. That solid steel bar, you heat it up enough beyond red glow and it starts flowing. It's a liquid. And that steel bar, you heat it up enough, it will become steel vapor. So everything you know about. If I take helium gas and I cool it low enough, it becomes nearly a solid under high enough pressure. Oh, by the way, there's a pressure relationship there too. So if I've got enough control of pressure and temperature, almost every substance has a solid form, a liquid form, and a gaseous form. So there's nothing magic about steel being solid and water being liquid and hydrogen being a gas, if you know what I mean. They all have a solid, a liquid, and a gaseous form. And almost all of them have a triple point. If you've got just the right pressure and just the right temperature in that container, you will have an equal volume of solid, liquid, and gas at the same instant of time in that container. That's a hard one to believe, but take my word for it. Let me drop. Now, let me go to the next step. Almost none of us understand what the hell a gas is. Okay? You've heard of something called Avogadro's number. 6.023, 10 to the 22, I think it is. 10 to the 23. Anyhow, that's the number of molecules of the substance if you have a gram mole of the substance. In other words, if I start off with helium, for instance, which has an atomic weight of 4, if I take exactly 4 grams of helium, there will be exactly Avogadro's number of helium molecules or atoms in that container. So my container contains 4 grams of helium, because helium has an atomic weight of 4. Avogadro's number tells me exactly how many helium molecules are in there. The next step in that is I can now know that since each helium molecule has a diameter in the vicinity of 1 angstrom, 10 to the minus 10 meter, I now know the size, approximately, of each helium atom in the container. I know exactly how many atoms of helium there. It's Avogadro's number. And if I know that my helium is at room temperature and room pressure, I can calculate exactly what the volume of that is. It's going to be very close to 1 cubic foot. Very close to 1 cubic foot of helium at room temperature and room pressure has exactly that number of molecules, Avogadro's number, and I know the size of every one of them. With a little bit more mathematics, I can calculate exactly what the spacing is between them. It's going to be around 63 nanometers is the spacing between them. I now know the density, the number, and the sizes, and the spacing between them. That's valuable information. Now let me give you another valuable piece of information that's really well kept secret. Let me drop. As I said, there's going to be a couple of errors in what I said, but it's going to get corrected. Hang in there. It's hard to believe the air molecules that are in that room with you right now are moving around. By the way, the definition of temperature, what your thermometer measures, everybody thinks the thermometer measures how hot or how cold. And that's sort of true. The next level of understanding is that what the thermometer is really measuring is average kinetic energy of those molecules. Every one of those molecules has a known amount of mass. You can look that up. You know exactly, if you know the temperature of the room, you know exactly how much kinetic energy every molecule has. You go through the mathematics of that, and you come up with a really surprising answer. Let me drop it. I should clear my throat because I'm hearing a whistle when I inhale. Look, thank goodness I'm listening to what I'm saying. You'll be amazed to find the air molecules in the room with you have an average speed of 500 meters per second. The first time I read that, I said, oh, that's going to be a typo. The guy, he missed a couple of decimal places when he wrote that down. And I went to a couple of other sources, and I found the same answer. I said, wow, 500 meters per second is the average speed of those air molecules. That's 1.5 times the speed of sound. That's the average speed of the air molecules. Notice that I didn't say velocity. The word velocity means it's a vector in which I've described how fast it's moving and exactly what direction it's moving. That's what velocity means. Because they're bouncing around each other billions of times per second. Each individual air molecule at 500 meters per second is meeting another air molecule and bouncing off of it. Billions of times per second. And every time there's a bounce, they end up both going in some other crazy direction. Predictable, like billiard balls on a pool table, but they're going into some other direction. Every few picoseconds, they're going to hit another one and bounce in some other direction. 500 meters per second, average speed. Boy, that is really something. And now, you have to realize the next thing. In between each one of those air molecules, what's there? You would say air. Uh-uh. The air molecules are the air. Let me drop. In between each air molecule is the world's most perfect vacuum. Nothing. That's a mind blower. The majority of the room that you're in contains vacuum. It happens to contain zillions and zillions of air molecules moving around 500 meters per second. But the majority of that room you're in is vacuum. Each one of these air molecules have a huge cloud of electrons on the outside of each atom, each molecule. And your oxygen happens to not be single atoms of oxygen for a whole bunch of reasons. The oxygen is O2. Two oxygen atoms get together and they say, hey, let's be friends. And so they hang together. All the oxygen in your room is really O2. The nitrogen in your room is N2. The helium in your room is helium. That one doesn't like joining with anybody else. The majority of the mass of the air in your room, oxygen and nitrogen, are O2 and N2. So there's two molecules per, but that's a minor variation. But this extremely strong electrostatic charge of the electron cloud around each one of those atoms slash molecules is so strong that when two air molecules hit each other, be careful on how you use the word hit, they never touch. They come extremely close to each other. As they come close to each other, the very strong negative charge of molecule number one sees the very strong negative charge of molecule number two. As they get close to each other by I forget whose law it is now, the electrostatic repulsion is huge. As they get close to each other, they sense a very strong repulsive force and they bounce away from each other. They never touch. They don't even come close to touching. They get close to each other and then move away because of electrostatic repulsion. That means every single bounce is perfect. No energy is lost. They don't touch.
Repeater, time out.
They don't touch each other. They don't collide. They don't disturb each other. They don't even hit. They just come close and bounce away with perfect bounce. That's what happens with the individual air molecules. Okay, what happens with the wall? The wall is made out of a solid material that's got these clouded electrons around each one of the molecules of the wall. The molecules of air coming up to the wall, roaring at it at 500 meters a second, gets close to the wall and never touches the wall. The exact same electrostatic repulsion takes place. Therefore, all the bounces of the air hitting the wall are a perfect bounce. All the bounces of the air molecules touching each other are a perfect bounce. No energy is lost. You can take a volume of air at room temperature with all of these. Each individual air molecule is bouncing off another air molecule or against the wall billions of times per second. Every bounce is perfect. No energy is lost. So you take this volume of air, in the case of a gram a mole of air, roughly a cubic meter of it, where it's got to roughly 29 grams of weight, because that's the average weight of air, atomic weight of air, around 29 grams. So you've got 29 grams of air, 1 cubic meter of it, 1 cubic foot of it, and you put it into a perfect calorimeter. In other words, it's an insulated container where there is no thermal energy flowing in or out. I know this is off to one side, but believe it or not, it's going to help. Let me drop. So you've got this perfectly thermally insulated 1 cubic meter of air that started off at room temperature. All of these air molecules are bouncing across each other billions of times per second, bouncing off the walls billions of times per second. The potential energy loss should be huge. You've got a thermometer inside of there, and through the window on this chamber, you're looking at the thermometer, and you study it for the next minute, hour, week, year, and the temperature doesn't change. You say, what's going on here? Billions and billions of bounces. There should be all kinds of energy loss in every bounce. Those 2 billiard balls on your pool table, when they hit each other, the energy coming off is less than the energy going in. Some of it, because of the compression of the billiard ball at the instant of impact, absorbs some of that energy. Everything we know about in the real world, every time there's a bounce, some energy is lost. That baseball hitting the bat loses a significant amount of energy, and it ends up a little bit hotter after it leaves that bat, and the bat ends up a little bit hotter. Some energy was lost in the case of heat. But at the molecular level, it's perfect. Wow. Interesting stuff to me. And that's why the temperature doesn't change, because every bounce is perfect. That meteorite that comes into the atmosphere, we say the friction creates the glow that makes it burn up. None of those air molecules touch that meteorite. It ain't moving fast enough. It's got to be moving at close to the speed of light before you would, like what you get in a particle accelerator, before you can penetrate that outer shell of electrons and touch the nucleus inside to really do something to it. Until you get close to the speed of light, you can't disturb a molecule. All those bounces are perfect. What happens with that meteorite hitting the atmosphere, let me drop, is the compression wave at the leading edge, PV equals NRT. You're compressing the air on the leading edge of that meteorite that's hitting at 40,000 miles an hour, if you know what I mean. Maybe it's even 40 miles per second, but really high velocities meteors come and hit the atmosphere. The compression wave on the leading edge creates the heating. It is not friction. It is not impact. There is no friction. There is no impact. The leading edge of a wing of an airplane flying at the speed of sound gets hot because of the compression wave, not because of friction. Everybody calls it friction. There ain't no friction. Craziness. Okay. Now, you want to know what those molecules look like when they bounce around, I recommend you go to a beautiful website. If you Google the word, what is it called now? Kinetic energy and air, or kinetic energy and molecules, you'll find the website. If you go to wikipedia.org/wiki, W-I-K-I, /kinetic_theory. I'll repeat that. wikipedia.org/wiki, W-I-K-I, /kinetic_theory. you go to that website, you'll see a beautiful diagram of air molecules slowed down by 30 billion to 1 in speed, and you watch those air molecules bounce around. And what will you see? Let me drop a call. You'll see those air molecules hitting each other, bouncing in crazy directions, hitting the walls. I'm saying hit, you know what I mean by hit? Encounter. They encounter each other, they encounter the wall. You see them bounce. You also see that occasionally an air molecule will bounce against two different guys in such a way that all of a sudden he almost stops in space. You'll see others bounce in such a way they get speeded up real fast. If you plotted the velocity of the individual air molecules versus their probability, you'll get a Gaussian-shaped curve. The average speed is 500 meters per second, but a hell of a lot of them are flowing faster than 500 meters per second. A hell of a lot of them are flowing less than 500 meters per second. There's a beautiful Gaussian curve of speed versus each one, versus the probability. But the average is 500, a beautiful number. Fluids flow at something like 640 meters per second. The water molecules at room temperature that are in your bathtub are flowing at 640 meters per second on average. And you're about to ask what's the difference between fluid and gas and solid. We're going to get there. Let me drop. And by the way, those fluid molecules flowing at 640 meters per second, again, there's a Gaussian distribution of them. Some of them are moving fast, some of them moving slower. The average is 640. When you climb out of that shower and you've got water on your skin, the water you know is evaporating. Everybody tells you how fast the heat comes off your body, 540 calories per gram. Each gram of water that evaporates absorbs 540 grams of heat, 540 calories of heat. We know how much. We don't know why. You ask the average chemist, the average chemical engineer, electrical engineer, physicist, whatever. Yeah, evaporation of water creates cooling. We know that. When you go from rain, water vapor to rain during a thunderstorm or during a hurricane, tremendous amounts of heat are released in the process that sustains the operation. Where's the heat coming from? 540 calories per gram, again, tells you how much, not why. Once you start looking at the molecular level, and this very smart guy of yours who asked the question, he's got the right kind of curiosity, in my opinion, John, let me drop. You know that some of the water molecules are racing toward the surface, and some of them are going to jump off of the surface. We call that evaporation. That water on your skin is evaporating. But which ones are evaporating? There's a whole Gaussian distribution of velocities of the water molecules. Some of them are moving faster than 640 meters per second. Some of them are moving slower. Temperature is the average kinetic energy. That means their velocity, 1/2 mv squared. The ones that are moving faster, the hotter water molecules, roar up to the surface faster and they jump off. The faster moving ones have a higher probability of jumping off. They're the hot ones. The slower moving ones come up to the surface. They encounter surface tension and they don't leave. The cold ones stay, the hot ones leave. We call that cooling. The cold ones are the ones that's left over. You climb out of that shower and you're shivering. And you wonder why. Because the hot molecules, the fast moving ones in that water, are the ones that jumped off and evaporated. The hot ones leave, the cold ones stay, you get cold. No one's ever explained that to me. That's my internal model of it. Now let's go to the next step. Gas molecules, by way of that animation that you're going to see on that website, wikipedia.org/wiki/kinetic_theory. You go to that website, and there's quite a few others. You just Google the word kinetic theory of molecules, kinetic theory, and Google it. You're going to get some beautiful diagrams, but that's one of the best ones. So now we know what the gas molecules are doing. Let me drop. The next one we're going to go to is solid molecules. The chunk of steel at normal room temperature is a solid material. The individual molecules of steel are not translating. They are locked in position. And there's a zillion ways they can do it. Every solid material, with rare exception, contains a crystal lattice. That's a fancy way of saying you've got a whole bunch of little hexagons, triangles, cubes, or whatever. That's the substance. That's the crystal lattice. I could, if I want to, start off with a whole bunch of cubes. material. And if it happens to be a so-called mass-centric molecule, in other words, if this particular substance, the individual molecules will sit in the middle of each individual crystal lattice, I've now got a whole bunch of cubes. In the exact center of each cube, I've got the molecule of steel, we'll say, in this example. There's nothing magic about the cubes all being squares. They can be rectangles, hexagons, they can be triangles, they can be all kinds of ways, depending on the material. But I've now got individual molecules in the middle of each crystal lattice. They're locked in position. You could make believe, in the case of a mass-centric type of lattice, you could make believe there's a molecule in the center. You've got eight corners of that cube. You could make believe there is a spring connected from the molecule to each one of the eight corners. The molecule is locked in place by that spring, by the lattice. And now, what is the temperature of the steel? Those individual air molecules, the steel molecules, are vibrating back and forth on those springs. They're not translating. They stay in position. But as I heat up that chunk of steel, they vibrate back and forth with bigger and bigger deflection. The average kinetic energy of the molecules is now the bouncing back and forth on those springs. That's what the thermometer measures. Kinetic energy.
Repeater, time out.
If the thermometer is measuring something you and I call temperature, in kelvins, in centigrade, in Fahrenheit, in Rankine, use any system of units you like, what the thermometer is measuring is average kinetic energy, which really is motion, 1/2 mv². And it can be bouncing back and forth on those springs. And as you heat up the steel more and more, they bounce with greater and greater deflection of the springs. But the molecules do not leave their positions. That's what a solid is. They're locked in position by that crystal lattice and those springs. In my simple internal model of what I think a solid is. As you heat up the steel enough so that the bouncing of those molecules on those springs gets so violent, you eventually break those bonds that I call spring, and now you've gone from the solid form to the liquid form of the steel. Now the molecules are able to flow. They're able to really move. It's now a fluid. When the temperature is high enough that you break the bonds that you and I call springs, you've now made them move so violently that the springs can no longer hold them in position. That's how you've gone from solid to liquid. And what's the difference of the liquid versus gas? That's a more difficult one. I'm going to hold that until next week. I'm hoping I'm going to find some other website that shows you a picture of this great big crystal lattice with a whole bunch of individual molecules locked in position by all of these springs, and they're vibrating back and forth on those springs. I wasn't able to find that particular website for this particular discussion that I knew was going to come, but it'll come. This is far from the whole story. And by the way, why does the bottom of your bicycle pump get hot when you're pumping up a tire? PV equals NRT tells you how much, doesn't tell you why. A very different process is going on. Those air molecules inside of that pump started off at 500 meters per second. You push down the handle on the pump so that you compress the air by a 4-to-1 ratio, and now the temperature goes up roughly four times the temperature it was in degrees Kelvin, absolute temperature. The air inside that pump is now super hot per se. The air molecules in the bottom of the pump that gets compressed are now moving twice the speed, 1,000 meters per second instead of 500 meters per second. When you and I push down on that pump, and we're pushing down on the pump with a couple of centimeters per second of velocity on the pump handle, we're doing very little in speed, so to speak. And yet those air molecules in the bottom of the pump end up moving 1,000 meters per second when they started off 500. Who did that? Where the hell did all of that velocity come from? I'm going to hold that one over until next week. That's a story like you wouldn't believe. How in the world did my bicycle pump do that? And why in the world didn't the guys teaching me thermodynamics, didn't they give me that detail? They gave me the equation, told me how much, they didn't tell me how or why. And I think I figured out how. It's a story that will amaze you. We'll hold that over to next week. We've only scratched the surface on this one, John, but for a guy who's got curiosity, like your writer, he's asked the right question. And when he finally finds the answer that nobody has told him. It'll make a little more sense. Memorizing the equation will make more sense. He'll be able to re-derive it. What's really going on at the molecular level will give him a lot more feeling for what's going on. It's the right question. KC2WGB, K2RIW, go ahead, John.
KC2WGB, very good, Dick. Well, maybe he's going to be able to go back to his teacher and explain to the teacher what's happening. And now he can realize that when a length of steel, 100 feet, expands approximately 1 inch maximum under a certain temperature range, it's due to those molecules of steel or the atomic structure of the steel just vibrating in place on its spring. It's not that the air gaps between them are getting larger. It's just a question of the vibration. Okay. So now he can go back to his teacher and impress him, maybe. Very good. Back to you, Dick.
Thanks, Ian. It's far from the whole story, but it's a little bit more of the information. Wes, please try to keep it brief. I know you want to add some information to this. N2XJN, K2LIW.
Well, the brief would be that I read nothing, because we have no time. Thank you very much. Beautiful lecture. Suggestion, go a little bit lower with the explanation of what is a molecule and what is happening there. What I would ask you, as we don't have a time, you say that whoever is signed, but we don't have a time for him to be first on the runway. Well, that never applies to me. I wonder why. I have a set of really beautiful emails that I have sent you, and you're going to be really, with your brain and your attention to that, you're going to be amazed. We're talking about the time crystal, and we're talking about the perpetual motion, and we're talking about space empty that is not empty. And to
explain. Okay, I'll try to see those 10 references you gave me in the last week. And some of them are very lengthy, and so you've overloaded me, Wes. You got to try to select a particular subject, not 10 subjects. I can't handle that. Now, I'm going to go over to I know we've kept Paul waiting an awful long time. Paul, thank goodness you can wait this long. And by the way, as I read more about the 30-meter telescope and the European Southern Observatory is going to, European Space Group is going to build a 40-meter telescope. And our previous example of really big telescopes was the 16-foot diameter telescope let's see, what's that now? 16 feet? It's around 5 meters. So Mount Palomar, which we used to think is a really big one, is only 5 meters, and these guys are talking about 30 and 40-meter telescopes. You ain't seen nothing yet as to what astronomy is going to... That, in my opinion, astronomy is one of the purest sciences there is, and these guys are getting some awful good information. And so, and I guess now we'll see. The Hubble Space Telescope, I think is... I should know how many meters it is. You're going to tell me. Go ahead then, Paul. WS2N, what's NASA doing now that's going to blow our mind? KQRIW and the dead man.
Before that, Dick, you didn't understand. I didn't give you 10 subjects. I give you one with 10 links to it. Just one. And you're going to love it. And to you.
Okay, looking forward to it. You got it, Paul.
Hey, this is WS2M for the space report. Eight feet is, I remember it in feet. 8 feet is the diameter of the Hubble, and give you an idea, the new James Webb Space Telescope for 2018 is going to be about 21 feet in diameter instead of meters. Roughly three times the diameter of the Hubble. And I'll have to read more about the 40-meter one and the 30-meter one. Sounds good, but I haven't gotten around to that yet, Dick. Just three topics. We don't have much time, so I'll just briefly go over a couple of the subjects. Opportunity, which is still operating on Mars, has now contacted Earth again. and so have the other orbiting satellites, because the Mars was on the opposite side of the Sun, called a solar conjunction. Anytime a planet is on, you know, on the opposite side of the Sun creates electromagnetic interference and knocks out all radio communications between Mars and Earth. So for roughly the last month, almost a whole month of April, all the contact between Mars with all the different orbiting satellites and the ones on the ground. You've got Curiosity, which has now come back to life. Let me drop it. Not that they weren't doing anything. They were programmed to do stuff. Everything from taking weather reports to looking under the ground for water. They were doing science and just storing it on board and eventually uploading it to the orbiting satellites, which act as a repeater and then send it back to Earth. Now that the solar conjunction is over. You've got Mars Express by the European Space Agency in orbit. You've got the Mars Global Surveyor, which is not working anymore for the last couple of years, but you do have Odyssey and Mars Reconnaissance Orbiter, which are both operating by JPL and continuing to do its own science, as well as acting as a repeater for the rovers. WS2N, stand by. So we'll be following the stories about what's going on on Mars. You've got another launch coming up this November to the red planet called the MAVEN, and that's going to be taking a lot of atmospheric measurements of the planet. We'll follow that mission as the months go on. By the way, if you want to, let's say, have your kids or grandkids send their names on a DVD to orbit Mars on MAVEN, you can do that now. I think you've got until July 1st to do that. You have to check into their website, and I believe the University of Colorado is handling that, the ones that were instrumental in building the MAVEN spacecraft. So, wanted to mention the Mars story also. The mission that just went up, the Antares flight that launched from Wallops Island, which was a very good success, built by Orbital Science, that went up successfully a couple of weeks ago. And I remember saying that they launched a couple of teeny tiny satellites. There was a gigantic, 5,000-pound dummy weight, representing what will eventually be the Cygnus spacecraft that will be attached to the Antares probably later this year, which will go up to the International Space Station to supply material. That's the goal of the mission. But, you know, since they put a launch up there, they did release three small satellites, and I mean small. They were about four inches cube, 4 inches on each side. Built for around $3,000.
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
On board were Motorola satellites, on these tiny cube satellites, and the goal was to send pictures of the Earth just using a cell phone, basically cell phone. That's really what it was, as a piece of transmitting equipment in space, and it worked. Actually, I found one website, and I was wondering if it was, a phony website. They showed four pictures of the Earth, and they said it was in the cell phone. But sure enough, the next day, it did show up on the NASA site, the same pictures. So it did apparently work. They used hams as well as the people involved with this project to collect the data, because they came down in packets, small packets, and they put all the packets together, and after doing that, it equaled the picture of the pictures that they wanted to see. So that was a success, all from the Antares launch. But their big missions will be later on. That company, Orbital Sciences, has a $1 billion-plus contract with NASA to send supplies on 8 different missions up to the International Space Station. Let me drop it. And running out of time here, but last thing I want to cover is the Virgin Galactic Spaceship 2 space plane. I think it was last Monday they ran their first test. They've run a lot of tests, drop tests with this thing. The idea of the Virgin Galactic Spaceship 2 plane is to send to suborbital flights people. They want to put at least 6 people on board every flight and have this thing turn around as often as it could land. They'll be able to take more people up. And the idea is to go on a suborbital flight, get the feeling of weightlessness for a while, and then you're going to see the horizon. You're going to be actually in space, and then you're going to return. They take you up on a carrier jet called the White Knight 2, and then you're dropped on this spaceship to a plane from 45,000 feet, 9 miles up, and after that, it lights, the engine lights, and you take off to outer space. Well, they ran the actual test with two pilots on board, dropping on Monday, and that was a success. They didn't go up to space. You know, they lit the engine for about 16 seconds, they said. So they dropped from, I think it was 45,000 feet up, and they went up to around 55,000 feet up, a couple of more miles. But it was the first firing of their jet, their rocket, which worked out okay. So we came down, landed, and you could sign on for this. You've got 500 people that have already put up their down payment for these $200,000 flights. That's what it's going to cost. Want to go to outer space, Dick? $200,000. I'm running out of time, but back to that WS2F. Just one more other comment, Dick, first, in case I don't get it back. If anybody needs to have any questions, or if they would like to have a topic discussed, a satellite that they haven't heard of in a while that we could research and bring up on the net, you can reach me at spacenetreport@gmail.com. spacenetreport@gmail.com. Back to you, Dick, WS2N.
Okay, that's your website, spacenetreport@gmail.com. Now, spacenetreport, REPORT, not abbreviated, as I'm guessing that, Paul. No punctuation, spacenetreport@gmail.com. Is that correct, Paul, as to your email address by which people can ask you these individual questions? WS2N, K2RIW, in the TechNet.
Yeah, I wanted a subcategory, but it would have been too long. But for TechNet/SpaceNet, it would have gotten too involved. But it worked out good this way. SpaceNetReport@gmail.com. All one word. SpaceNetReport. Back to you, Dick.
Very fine, Paul. So 500 people have already put down the down payment for a $200,000. Suborbital flight, which I understand correctly is going to be something like 45,000 feet. If they really want to have a space flight, I think the definition of space is when you're above, is it 50 kilometers or 100 kilometers? What is the current definition? I know that the Virgin Atlantic company flew this vehicle and got one of the X prizes by entering space twice with a commercial vehicle in the same 2-week period, if I remember correctly. And I think at the time the definition of the threshold of space was either 50 or 100 kilometers. me on that one, Paul. WS2N, K2LIW.
Yes, they had the space, their first spaceship looked like this one, but it was small, and they won the Ansari Prize, millions of dollars from Ansari, a guy that put the money up, and that was just a, if you could take a plane, like a rocket, and get into suborbital flight, and then within 2 weeks do the same thing, you win the money, and that's what they did. That was a couple of few years back. When they, since then, they've been working on this thing. It's going to be there when they're going to carry passengers in. And, yeah, well, this flight went up. It's carried up to 45,000 feet on another jet, and this White Knight 2 dropped it. And similar to the idea with what they used to do with the B-52s, you know, with the X-15s, they would drop it, and then it would light off and then take off. And that's what this did. And it just, this is only a test, so they only went up to 55,000 feet. But that's not space. I mean, this is only a test to show their rocket work from dropping. What they need to do is they've got to get up to anything over 100,000 kilometers, which is 60 miles, so you're right. If you go over 60 miles, you're into space, and you can consider yourself an astronaut. You'll remember this, as time goes on, when the Boeing company comes out with their spacecraft that's going to send people to the International Space Station called PST-100, and everybody wants to know what's the 100 for, and that's what it's for. That's the 100 kilometer mark. That's why they're calling their spacecraft that. That's Boeing. And none of a sudden, there's people to the space station. This was only a test, only up to 55,000 feet. Eventually, you've got to go all the way up to, you got to double that. You know, you're going that. That's only, 10 miles or so. You've got to get up to 60 miles. You've got to six times that height back to there.
Okay, 60-some-odd miles. 100 kilometers, I think, is now the definition of the threshold of space. If your altitude above the surface of Earth is 100 kilometers, you're in space. Let me run that by one more time just to be sure I got it right. 100 kilometers and above is considered an outer space, or nearby space, if you know what I mean. Is that true, Paul? WS2N, K2LIW.
USL deck, you have it. 100 kilometers or 60 miles, same thing. You're in outer space. Back here.
Let's see now. It's 60 some odd miles, 5,000 feet per mile. So we're talking about 300 and some odd thousand feet. 100 kilometers is space. And so to do that, 500 people have already signed up, knowing the ultimate cost is going to be $200,000. I'd like to believe that there's some kind of a health test that's required as a preliminary here, as a prerequisite. You've got to do some kind of a health test to make sure it's not a person that's going to get a coronary and during this event. You don't want the event to kill people.
I think you need a mental test.
I agree with you. Okay. Well, there are people who have got money to burn. It's hard for you and I to imagine that. So let me drop.
That's what I was going to say, John.
There are people on this planet who, with their website or whatever, they're so successful that to them $100,000 is just some of the outside leaves on their bankroll, if you know what I mean. It doesn't matter to them. We amateurs who are frugal people who worry about whether or not we're going to buy a Naofeng or a Waxon and how many dollars and how many features we're going to get in that handheld calculator and so on. We count our shekels and nickels and so on. For somebody to drop $200,000 to me is a lot of money. But there are people who can do that. I think one of those early guys spent quite a few million dollars to get onto the space station. I think it was like $10 or $20 million. I'm going to turn it back to Paul in a minute for a repeat on that one. So if you've got the money, but if you've ever of these carnival rides that put you to weightlessness, you got to know that your heart's going to be racing, your mind's going to go crazy, and whatever, unless you're really used to it, unless you're a person who's got a death wish, the normal self-defense mechanism inside of a human being are going to make your psyche go crazy the first time you become weightless. It's hard to believe that with all of that training, let me drop it. With all of those medical tests and training of our astronauts and cosmonauts, these are people who have been pilots for years. They got a whole lot of flight training. When they go into space, one of the best kept secrets is that 50% of all of the astronauts, 50% of all the cosmonauts, spend the first 24 hours in space buffing. They get seasick, space sick, whatever. When you get continuous weightlessness for a prolonged period of time, and there are astronauts who have had two flights on the space shuttle and they didn't get sick, on the third one they do. And you can try Dramamine and everything else and it helps. But something like 50% of them, they don't advertise this, they all get sick. So of these 500 people about to go into space, and the majority of them do not have flight training, they do not have the experience, I wouldn't be a bit surprised to find that 80% of them are going to get space sick. Maybe not, because the period is so much more brief. I'll admit that the astronauts and cosmonauts, that when they go into space, let me drop, when they get sick, maybe it's a couple of hours downrange of getting into space where they get sick. And maybe the brief encounter these guys are going to have, and that's another question I'd like to know, Paul, these people are going to go into a suborbital flight. Does that mean the total amount of weightless time is going to be, let me pick a number, 10 minutes or something like that? So give us some more words on this one, Paul. And I can tell that you and I and John are not going to sign up for it. Maybe Glenn has got the chutzpah, but I don't. WS2N, K2LIW on the tech net.
Some years ago, I remember, I think it was going to be 5 minutes or so of weightlessness, which is better than an Obama comet, what they test people on. A couple of those things. NASA has one, and then there's a private company that's running it. And they last 30 seconds for each parabolic arc, and this might go on 10, 15 times during, you know, one flight, you know, for testing a group of people. So, even Stephen Hawking went on that one. They got him, and they let him float around on those parabolic arcs. But, 5 minutes. So, but the point is, you're going to see the curvature of the Earth and all, and it's probably very cool. And it's probably about an hour or two flight, because it takes you about 45 minutes or so to get up to 45,000 feet before they drop you. And then you get some time, quite a bit of time to come down. You're not coming down on a parachute. You're going to land in an airport, and he's got a launching facility, you might call it, in New Mexico. That this is going to happen. And right now this happened in the Mojave Desert out in California. That's where they're testing this thing. Prices, let me drop it. Yeah, $200,000 for that. Dennis Tito went up. He was the first tourist in space. They took him up. You know, that was $20 million. Russians took him up. And stayed about 4 or 5 days, I think, in space, on the space station, maybe a little longer. And then they had other guys, this guy Mark Shuttleworth, and the price kept going up. He was from South Africa, and maybe about 4 or 5 other people since. And I think they're up to around $30 or $40 million per trip now. Drop it. That includes all your training and everything that goes on in Star City. And the U.S. astronauts, I think we're getting ripped off. You know, they're charging us now. I just read this a week ago. $70 million per astronaut. Usually we get one per blast that go up there. And but you know, you got to realize they're sending us up, and we're staying up there for 6 months, and now it's going to be a year. They're going to start in with 1 year missions. So maybe they're getting their money's worth of $70 million. But the tourists usually last maybe a week or so, and then they come back. Thank you, Dick.
Good information. Wow. So Dennis paid $20 million. Mark Shuttleworth paid something like $30 or $40 million, or could have. And the U.S. astronauts paid $70 million to get into space, to really get into space at the altitude of the International Space Station. Huh. I can think of better ways of spending my money than to go on this ride. And by the same token, the slightly crazy people that want to climb Mount Everest, which is a very life-threatening situation. You get above 22,000 feet or so and dwell there for a while. It is killing off brain cells. It's a very wicked environment. And trying to get up to 29,000 feet just to say you did it. I climbed Mount Everest. And I got the bragging rights. You're putting your life really at a lot of risk when you do that. Mr. Virgin Atlantic, I can't think of his name right now, he apparently is going to make this a pretty safe system if I know him. He's got lots of backups to it. So 500 people have signed up. In the old days, let me drop it.
His name is Branson, by the way.
Branson, what's his first name again?
Oh, I don't know, Virgin. I forgot.
Mr. Branson, yeah, a very dynamic guy of Virgin Atlantic. And I think he also funded one of these balloon trips that took a circumnavigation of the Earth with that balloon trip. I think he financed one of those too, didn't he, Bulk?
I think he went on one, didn't he? He went on with two other guys. One guy, but he eventually got himself killed in an airplane doing something out in Nevada somewhere. He got himself lost. That's what happened to him. Boston, I think his name
was. I recognize that incident. Okay, so there's lots of fun things to do. We amateurs can do something reasonably dangerous, but it's got a lot of benefit in the background, and that is put up radio towers. I mean, I've had at least 100 feet of radio tower on my property ever since 1969 on the current piece of property. It was a 60-foot high tower on a piece of rental property where I was there for 4 years. So by way of the number of hours I've spent with my body either 60 feet or 100 feet above the ground is quite significant. And thank goodness to a real good safety harness and careful procedures and whatever, I managed to survive it. And I'm not doing it just for bragging rights. I have a fear of height. Whenever I spend more than, we'll say, half an hour above 60 feet on a radio tower, I will spend the next two nights having nightmares about falling off a tower. It's just something that's built into me. I'm willing to put up with that because I like my antennas to be high up. I like to have good radio operation. Let me drop. And when it comes to Sirius VHF, UHF, SHF, on 10 gigs, where a 200 milliwatt, 2/10 of a watt QRP rig with a little 2-foot dish on 10,000 megacycles can allow me to torque 380 miles on single sideband. And in theory, I can do that some portion of every 24-hour day because the band opens that often up there. That, to me, is exciting. How in the world does that radio signal do that? Or correspondingly, the Voyager spacecraft, which is now at something like 110 astronomical units. 39 astronomical units is Pluto. So this thing is almost three times the distance of Pluto, transmitting a signal at roughly 8.5 gigahertz, 5 watts of it. Let me drop. As an engineer, I can calculate for you to the nearest couple of tenths of a dB how strong the signal is going to be on the Earth. You tell me how many watts are being transmitted, roughly 5 watts, into something like a 10-foot diameter dish. I think it's the size of the dish on Voyager. Coming down to the Goldstone dish, 240 feet diameter in the Mojave Desert. It's at Fort Irwin, and that is part of the Mojave Desert in Goldstone, California. You tell me how many watts, how many miles, how big are the antennas on each end, I can tell you to the nearest fraction of a dB how strong that signal is going to be that you're receiving. It's calculatable. as radio enthusiasts haven't got the vaguest idea what is that radio signal. What does it really look like? We got a bunch of crazy diagrams with E horizontal and H vertical, and we say that that's what the wave looks like if you could see it. I don't believe it. There ain't no E, is my belief. I mean, there's lots of ways I can make an E field on the Earth by way of a G-temp. We're out of time. I won't go any further with that.
That's exactly what I was referring to. When you look at the world of symmetry, but the professor, he's Nobel Prize winner, Polish guy, actually, Polish-American. You're going to love it.
We'll soon find out. But to establish an E-field inside of a GTEM, as Glenn and I have done, and as Charlie has done, the VA2 Horse Mounted Mobile, HMM, the guys who have run a GTEM, which creates a very predictable amount of E-field, you've got an upper conductor, a lower conductor, and you put some number of volts between it. You're launching electrons onto metallic conductors with a certain distance between the two, and that creates an E-field. And along comes the radio scientists who claim that there's some number of volts per meter in space when there's no conductor and no electrons. Not a single electron leaves that antenna. And yet we claim there's an E-field out there. I do not believe it. I believe all of the magic is in the magnetics. That's not an easy one to understand. We'll be discussing that as time goes on. We'll eventually get to the bottom of that mystery all these years downrange. What does that radio wave really look like? TechNet number 1448 is what you guys just heard. We're being cut off. 7301. Be kind to each other. Let's see if I can make this a little bit better. Be kind to each other. See you guys next week. And keep the faith. Keep the radio faith. And you got to slowly teach all the people in your neighborhood that radio is their friend. It's not their enemy. Stop resisting the installation of cell sites. It's what keeps people alive. Bye-bye, you all. Sorry, John, I didn't give you a chance. Oh, if you got a... Oh, I waited getting through here to see your class. That's John. KC2WGB. Thank you. K2IIW in the TechNet.
Right, WBE3KIW.
You say you lose your net, but we still hear you. What is it you lose at midnight?
Okay, Jim. Jim, at my request, not everyone's going to agree with this, at my request, I asked the people who run the machinery of this particular network, I've asked them to cut off the machine at midnight. The reason for that is because the TechNet in the 30 years ago started at 8 o'clock at night and ran to 9 o'clock, 1 hour. And people started complaining more and more that 8 is not enough time to really ask the questions and get the answers from all that brain power in the tri-state area of New York, New Jersey, Connecticut. So it became 2 hours. Eventually it became 3 hours. For the last 6 years, it has been 4 hours. And on one or two occasions, the really enthusiastic guys, let me drop. On one or two times, the really enthusiastic guys, we ran into 1 o'clock, 2 o'clock in the morning, local time. That was 5 and 6 hours. Well, I got to get up the next week, next day, go to work, as a number of other people did. So I asked them to put a timer on the machine to, on Sunday night, kill the main machine at midnight. Well, I got the back door by which I can get into the machine when I really have to, and what you're listening to. So yes, from your point of view, it doesn't get cut off. The input to the machine does come out by the internet connections. But on the main 146.85 output of the machine, it is cut off at my request. Not only will we agree with that, but at least it's something to create an end to it, because other than that, we couldn't create an end without creating a more frayed networks, if you know what I mean, Jim. E3JIW, does that make some sense? K2LIW in the segment. It isn't the segment anymore. K2LIW all by itself. You got it, Jim.
Okay, there's the cop.
Very good. If you were going to consider liquid solid gas next week, you could mention whether you're talking about pure things like iron or alloys like steel. Then you can get into how is it mechanical abuse that is given to the raw material to make a samurai sword affects the material.